All right, good morning. As I always say before any of my talks, I'm not an expert on the matter, and it's certainly not exhaustive. We can really do like a three-part series on the death penalty from different angles. But for today, we'll do our best. So there's really three ideas, three subtopics of the death penalty as seen through the lens of Judaism. Okay, so one of them would be the biblical or Talmudic view of the death penalty for non-murderers, and I'll explain in a second what I mean. The second would be the biblical or Talmudic view of the death penalty in Jewish law for murderers, which is the classic case of the death penalty. I'll explain. Which, obviously, when you talk about the death penalty, you talk about questions of, do we really want to put this person to death? Right? Like, even though they're a murderer, do we really want to put them to death? Will it help deter future murders? All the kinds of philosophical questions that come along with the death penalty. So how is that seen through Jewish law? And then the third would be Judaism's view of the death penalty in general society, in secular society. Again, so there's a difference between within the Jewish law, like if the the great court, the Sanhedrin, was running things, would they put someone to death for killing someone, and what do we think about the terms of the general law of the land and our view on it, which could be separate things. And related topics for another time would be like extrajudicial slayings, which means like if a person wanted to take avenge his relative's death, could they do so on their own? They're not really the death penalty, but they're doing it for a valid reason, as well as the very interesting topic of a king, a Jewish king, who, through different sources, it seems like they have jurisdiction and discretion to do what they need, what they feel is necessary, really anything, right? And the concept of rebellion against a king in Jewish sources, where a king could really take the law into his own hands if he feels like someone's rebelling against him. And there are examples of that, but we're not going to talk about that. The first thing that we have to say with full disclosure is that a death penalty, put aside if someone killed someone, right? I'm just going to talk about, in general, the Jewish law perspective on putting someone to death as a penalty. So there is that concept, certainly, right? In fact, the Mishnah and the Talmud, it tells us that there's four forms of death, which is a little bit gory, right? I'm actually just started to study this chapter. And there are four types of death, so there's beheading, there's stoning, there's putting a burning, not actually burning, but like a hot coal.
Hanging.
What?
Hanging.
So hanging is not one of the four, but sometimes it's done right after, like for an idolater, they would be hung for a little bit, but not overnight. But hanging is not one of the four. The last one that I didn't mention is strangling. Okay, so it sounds very morbid and harsh, and so we'll get to that in a second, whether it was put into practice in reality. But theoretically, from the outset, there are these four forms of the death penalty. As I said, for idolatry, for sexual indiscretions, right, incestual type things, do come with the death penalty on the books. That, you know, that is what it is. It's mentioned in the Torah, and it's mentioned in the Mishnah. Different people are subject to different types of death because they're actually ranked which one is worse. And there's a machloket, there's an argument about which ones are worse. Okay, so that is the case. However, there are some provisions for a person. Let's say a person worships idols, right? But they do it in their own home, right? And no one saw it. But then someone heard about it, or heard a rumor about it, and told the court. And so now the court knows who it is. So the question is, is the court supposed to or allowed to punish that person with stoning, which should be the punishment? So the answer is no, because you need two witnesses, and you need the witnesses to warn the person that what he's about to do, he should not do, right? You should not worship idols, and if you do so, right, you'll be punished by stoning, right? So, and then the person has to say, I don't care, and I do it anyway, okay? So at that point, theoretically, again, he is subject to stoning. Theoretically. But he needs to be warned, and he needs to have two witnesses. So if you do it in your own home, even if people hear about it, but since no one witnessed it, you would not be subject to any punishment. Or if witnesses saw it, but they forgot to warn you about it and what your punishment would be, again, you would not get anything. Okay, the question again is, practically, how do we apply this rule? That if you did have two witnesses, and they did make a proper warning, and the guy did it anyway, so would he still be, would the Beis Din, would the Sanhedrin, would the judges actually act on the death penalty, which is prescribed? Or would they not? So that's a question. Okay, so let's put that aside for a second, and we'll come back to that. Let's talk about what would happen if a Jew would kill another Jew. Okay? So, like in secular law, there is a difference between if they would do it by accident or on purpose. In fact, there's lots of Mishnayot that discuss if a person was chopping wood, let's say, and the handle of the axe was not tight, and all of a sudden you're trying to chop, you know, in your own property, and the blade of the axe flies to your neighbor's property and unfortunately kills your neighbor.
How do you prove that it wasn't arranged?
That's a good question. Actually, that's a very good point. It's actually discussed if a person was known to have a dislike, stronger than a dislike, like a real antipathy to his neighbor, a real hatred, whether it was not an accident or whether it was something more than that. That's a good point. But let's assume you're on good terms and it really was an accident, right? So obviously in that case, just like in secular law, you would not be put to death, right? Even in a state which had the death penalty. Rather, you would run to what's called the Arei Miklat, which are cities of refuge, and it's a very interesting method and procedure that a person goes to one of these. There's really like 48 cities in Israel, and if you reach it, it's like sanctuary, and they can't. You can't be harmed. But if you're not there, so technically the relative of the person that you killed, even by accident, can take revenge on their relative's life and try to kill the accidental murderer. However, we're told that there are Torah scholars that try to dissuade and persuade the person not to go through with it, even though they feel really, right? You can imagine the relative, you're in anguish that this happened to your relative, that he was killed even by accident. And you might want to do something about it, and yet, but we remind the person that it was an accident. It was not intentional. And so you have to let it go, right? Perhaps forgive, but either way, but technically there is that idea, okay? So that's if you do it by accident. And of course, again, in secular law, if you do it by accident, even in a place that has the death penalty, you're not going to be put to death. Let's say you do it on purpose, premeditated, right? So, oh, before I get to premeditated, let's say you do it on purpose, but it's because it's an intruder into your home. So there's different laws in regard to that, but that's more complex because you're responding. So perhaps what you're supposed to do is try to, like if you have a gun, you're trying to shoot the person, not in the face, but in the leg, right? They're intruding into your home. You don't know if they're armed or not, so you're protecting yourself. But if you can, you should try to protect yourself by shooting them in one of their limbs so that they can't run away, but not to try to kill them.
He also can say, I thought he was an intruder.
You thought?
Yeah.
That's true. Well, so if a person comes to kill you, the Jewish law is that you are supposed to kill them, right? You're not supposed to, you know, you shouldn't say to yourself, oh, I can't kill that person. No, if they're coming to kill you, you kill them. In the case of an intruder, it could be that you have reason to think that they're armed, but it's complicated. But you might be right.
Because I can say I thought so.
Right, right. Okay, fine. But technically, in that case, so it's hard to say that you would get the death penalty. Again, so we're talking about premeditated murder. A person was warned by two witnesses, and he did it anyway. So in that case, theoretically, he would be put to death. I believe it would be beheading, would be the death penalty. Okay. So the question is, first of all, how often did this actually happen that a Jew killed another Jew? So putting aside, someone mentioned this to me yesterday, the Jewish mafia, which I know not as much about because it doesn't really exist nowadays, but in the 30s and the 40s, apparently it did, in New York, Murder, Inc., you know, Jewish gangsters, etc., etc. So whatever that was.
Detroit had a big one.
Okay, Detroit had a big one. I'm not asking any questions. But in terms of Jews killing other Jews, how often did that really happen? I mean, it's a horrible thing to think about. Yet, we're told in the Talmud that the First Temple period, there was, apparently, because people, one of the three reasons for the three sins that the First Temple was destroyed was because of murder, the other two being idolatry and arayot, immorality, you know, incestuous type of relationship. So apparently it did exist. I need to look further and see if there are any accounts of how much and how prevalent it really was and what the motives would be. Because, okay, you think about, you know, the immorality type of stuff. People are lustful, so and then the idolatry is hard for us to understand, but apparently it was a big draw, even to worship, you know, a stone idol. Right? In fact, the Talmud says that there was a Jewish king named Menashe who He served idols, like, a lot, and so he was criticized by a rabbi much later in the Talmud. And so Menasseh, the king, comes to the guy in the dream, and he says, if you would have been there, you would have been holding up your frock, your cloak, to run after the idols to serve it. In other words, you can't judge me. You weren't there. If you were there, you would know that there was such a lust for idolatry. We don't understand why, but apparently there was. But in terms of murder, what would be like the reason to murder someone? I guess if you develop a hatred for them, but Jews are really not supposed to, or not really prone to that. But okay, so it happens, right?
Is it a similar crime if a Jew kills a non-Jew?
I think it's the same.
Killing is killing.
I think it's the same. Yeah. Oh, so yeah. Okay. So you're right. A Jew killing.
Self-protection is one thing.
Yeah. Right. No. 100%. A Jew killing a non-Jew. It's the same thing. And a non-Jew killing a Jew. If we were in, if that happened in Israel back in biblical times when we had courts and everything, right? Non-Jews have the Sheva Mitzvot B'nei Noach. They have the seven Noahide laws, one of them being don't kill. So it really goes both ways. Okay, now I want to go to the value of human life and the gravity of being a witness to a murder. Okay, so this is the first source that you have. It's a little bit long, but it's very interesting, and we'll go through it. It's on those of you that have the sheet. It's the first one. This is a Mishnah from Sanhedrin, which is all about courts and these kinds of things. So I'll read it, and you can read along, and then we'll, if you have any questions or comments about it, we'll analyze it. But again, this is a Mishnah, and you'll see different points in terms of the value of human life and how we ask witnesses and how we press them, which is related to how we feel in reality about the death penalty. So the Mishnah says, how do we press the witnesses in a capital case? Meaning, if we have witnesses that say that they saw a murder between Jonah, we saw it, we have two witnesses, right? Moses and Aaron testify that Jonah killed Reuben, right? That Jonah killed Reuven. So we bring them in and we press them. Perhaps what you say isn't your own testimony, but your own assessment, or from rumors, or you're witnessing an actual witness testify, or you're reporting what a trustworthy say. In other words, maybe you didn't really see it. Maybe it was a different guy, right, that's not here. It wasn't him. Or maybe you thought you saw it, but really you heard about it, but you didn't actually see it. Or really what you're saying is that you were behind a building and you heard circumstantial evidence. You heard the gunshot, and you heard some other evidence as to what happened, but you didn't actually see it. So you're in your mind, you're doing it, but you don't know. You don't know 100% that this guy killed the other guy. Or perhaps you were unaware that by the end we'd interrogate you with examination and inquiry. Know that capital cases are not like monetary ones. In monetary cases in Jewish law, a false witness, right? You know, I saw Joe steal $1 million from Lewis, right? Two guys say. And it turns out that they're in cahoots with Lewis. And so they're all going to split the money afterwards. But they first have to say that it was stolen and that Joe needs to pay back. Really, it didn't happen. But in that kind of case, you can return the money and you can achieve atonement. You can give the money back. I mean, unfortunately, theft can you can't always just return the money. It's not always that simple. Sometimes the money disappears. But theoretically, you can return the money. But in capital cases, again, this is the judges speaking to the witnesses. The blood of the victim and all his future offspring hang upon you until the end of time. Why? Because we see in regards to Cain, right? Cain and Abel, the two brothers, which is the first recorded history of murder in the Bible, who killed his brother, God says, the bloods, plural, of your brother scream out. The verse does not say the blood of your brother, but bloods of your brother, because it was his blood and also the blood of his future offspring screaming out. In other words, that if you're testifying falsely, if you got it wrong, and we're going to really put this guy to death, and he really didn't do it, not only are you killing an innocent person, but you're killing any future descendants. So it's a big deal. Just like we find with Cain, we say that Abel's, not only Abel's life was taken, but also Abel's, any future potential descendants are also gone forever. Now it's a very interesting point that the Mishnah says, it was for this reason, skip a couple to the third line in the middle, it was for this reason that man was first created as one person, right? Why did God create only Adam and then Eve from Adam? Why didn't he create a little town of 1,000 people right away? 500 men, 500 women, right? They'd have kids. Soon you'd have, you know, a couple.
Don't we have an image of God as a man that he created in his own image?
I think the commentaries say that in his own image means other things, not necessarily gender, more like able to speak.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And man with a capital M, I'm not saying a male as opposed to a female, I'm saying humans, like mankind. Yeah. But the question is, why did he only create one individual? Why not create 1,000, right? It's much more efficient that way. You can get a jump start on the world. So the idea is that there's a number of lessons that we learn. Again, maybe we don't know if this is the reason, but so the first one, which is connected to our case, is that a person that you might have heard this, a person that destroys a life, even a single life, is as if they destroyed an entire world. Because at one point, the entire world consisted of one person, Adam. So if someone would have killed Adam, you would have killed the whole world, because he was the whole world for that amount of time.
So how did they multiply if there was only one man?
So we're told that Eve, Chava, was created from Adam. But it was Adam, and then Eve came a little bit later. But for those few hours, it was just Adam. So the lesson is that if you destroy one person, nowadays, if you kill one person, it's as if you killed an entire world. Meaning that
every person matters.
Every person matters, 100%. And they can have descendants, which now they can no longer have. They could have had, you know, future families. And also, right, unfortunately, you know, in these types of victims of these types of killings, one person means a lot of different things to different people, right? They're a brother, and they're a son, they're a father, they're an employee. So they mean different things to different people. So they really are an entire world, so to speak, not just, you know, he's not just a number, they're a whole world. Okay, so but also the contrary. If you save a life, it's as if you saved the whole world, right? And save could mean, you know, save them from a burning building, but it can also mean save them, if they're alone and you help them, and you connect them with other people, and you raise their spirits. That kind of thing also, in a sense, is like saving the person, and you're also saving the whole world, because who knows?
Every person matters.
Who knows, by helping that one person and saving them, what could happen?
A whole generation.
A whole generation, right. Also, just, and I'll go through this quickly, because it's not exactly related, but it's in the Mishnah, to promote peace among the creations, so that no man would say to his friend, my ancestors are greater than yours. Right? Some people say, oh, I come from a greater family. But if we say, no, everyone comes from one man, so no one's greater than anyone else. That's why God created just one person. For that reason. Another reason, so that heretics won't say there are many rulers up in heaven, that multiple gods each created their prototype man, right? That there are 100 gods and 100 men, and each man was created by their god. So the answer is no, one man created by one god. And also, this is the last point in this little topic here, to express the grandeur of God, because when you mint coins, so you mint, thousands of pennies all at once from one mint. But God was able to create different individuals with different feelings and different thoughts from the first man, as if Adam was the prototype. But from Adam comes different personalities to show you that how God can do that. And therefore, every person must say, for my sake, the world was created, which is not an ego thing. It's more of a self-empowerment, self-esteem, that you shouldn't think of yourself as insignificant, because every man... every man was created, so to speak, individually from Adam, right? That no man is quite like their friend. Everyone is different. Okay, fine.
Everyone has his own destiny.
Everyone is unique. Yeah. Hold on 1 second. Okay. Yeah.
Those who were wrongdoing.
Mm-hmm.
But we have learned over the centuries that murder, the concept of if I do this, nobody's going to like it and I'm going to be killed.
Mm-hmm.
People kill through accident because they're angry.
Uh-huh.
And that they do not respond to the idea of a penalty. I don't believe in capital punishment.
Okay.
Because I don't think it has been proven. Who was it that said, maybe Nietzsche,
I think you're talking about Camus, but...
that murder is not going... The concept of
It's not a deterrent.
It's not going... And I'm... The idea right. that they're going to lynch me, I'm too angry...
It's not going to deter you from doing it.
So why do it? Why do away with the death? Why not do away with the death?
Okay, so let's put that on hold, because I'm going to get to the different philosophies about the death penalty, like what you're saying, in a second. I first want to just... Okay, so let's keep that thought in mind, and we'll get to that shortly. Okay. I just want to finish the Mishnah for just a second, but we'll get back to that. So maybe the witnesses, now back to our storyline about the witnesses. So maybe the witnesses will say, why do we need this and all this anxiety, right? Because what you're doing is you're testifying, and now you're getting peppered by questions from the court. Did you really see it? And also we're told that the Talmud says there's a lot more questions that are asked. What time of day and what day of the month and what shoes, what color shirt was the guy wearing, etc., etc. We ask them a million questions. So at some point they might just say, you know what, I may have seen something, but I'm going to go home now. I'm tired of all the questions, and also I don't want to be responsible for putting someone to death based on my testimony. I'm going home. I don't want to be part of this. So, so they respond by saying, but the Torah has already spoken and says, if you're a witness, if you don't express your testimony, you will bear your sin. That if you saw something and you don't say something, that is a problem. Because if you really saw something in a crime, you're obligated to... Right. You're responsible for mentioning it. Okay? Despite the anxiety that is going on, you still have an obligation to mention it. And now you'll say, why are we going to be responsible for another man's death? But the answer is, Scripture has already spoken. When the wicked are destroyed, this is a verse from Proverbs, when the wicked are destroyed, there is rejoicing. Now that verse is actually contradicted by another verse, and that could be for another topic, another class about rejoicing when at the downfall of your enemies. Should we be happy when evildoers are dead? Should we be happy or not? But that's another question. But for our purposes, we tell the witnesses that if you actually saw something, and the guy was really a wicked person, so you have an obligation to mention what you saw and that you warned him. And don't worry, don't be scared of giving your testimony, because there's a value to punishing those that do evil. So don't hesitate if you are really 100% sure of what you saw, because we're actually happy when a wicked, evil person who has committed a crime is punished. So that's what we tell the witnesses. So there's a couple notes from the Mishnah, and tell me if you have your own. The first note is that we see that we push the witnesses to the limit in terms of affirming what they saw, right? And we actually do this in all aspects of testimony. We always push the witnesses, and we cross-examine, and we try to see if one witness and the other witness, if their stories aren't exactly the same. Maybe they're lying. Maybe they didn't see it like they thought they did. So we're very careful with that. And also our judges that are in the courts are they're vetted, right? They're the sharpest of the sharp, right? And we're actually told in Ethics and Pirkei Avot that you should be mitunim badin. You should be very careful as a judge in your judgment, right? If you need extra time to think about it, don't hesitate. Okay? Fine. So that's the first thing. When you start to see that we are hesitant to put someone to death, because if we weren't, we would just say to the witnesses, You saw it? You saw the murder? You think you... Yeah, we saw it. Okay, all right. He's an evil person. Let's get the electric chair ready. But we don't. We don't do that. We say, are you sure? And, if you're wrong, you're destroying a whole world. Okay? Etc., etc. Okay, so that's the first indication of our hesitancy to actually put someone to death by trying to push the witnesses. And if the witnesses would say that, oh, well, maybe not. I'm not sure. I don't remember what day it was. I'm not sure. Maybe I did hear it, right? You start to doubt yourself. So
there should be no maybe.
Right. Maybe. It needs to be 100%. Right? So if you start to say that, so then we'll tell the witnesses, okay, we appreciate you coming forward. We're not sure if we can accept your testimony at this point because you don't seem to be 100% conviction. Right. We're gonna wait. Maybe there'll be more witnesses, other witnesses, but you're free to go, and we're not gonna accept your testimony.
There's a famous saying: better the guilty, let the guilty go, than the innocent to be punished.
I'm gonna bring that up in a second. Right, that's from the Rambam, Maimonides. Very good. The second thing I see from the Mishnah is the value of human life, which is kind of obvious. We said it before, but you really see it in the Mishnah, that Judaism obviously values the preservation of human life, right? We don't want to put a person to death if we're not sure 100%, 110% that they actually did it. But at the same time, the value of human life in a murder case can go both ways, right? You read about, was reading about it today, the case in South Carolina in the church, horrible case, where someone murdered a couple other, 9 other people. So if we say, oh, well, you know, if we really value human life, so yes, we need to make sure that we're sure that the alleged actually did it before we kill them. But once we are convinced, so the person needs to be punished if we really value the human life of those that were lost, of those that this person killed. It goes both ways. The victims and the alleged, there's human life on both sides. Now, perhaps the answer is life in prison and not the death penalty, right? But either way, they need to be punished. If we really believe in human life, it really goes both ways. That's kind of obvious. Now I want to get to philosophies in general on the death penalty, or is it good or not. So we already started to talk about it. So on your sheet, I believe there's, I put 2 separate quotes. One quote, and they're both very interesting, because one quote seems to be pro the death penalty and gives a reason why. And the other quote from the other philosopher gives a reason why you should not do the death penalty. So the first one is from Albert Camus, which I think is similar to what you were saying. Capital punishment is the most premeditated of murders, to which no criminal's deed, however calculated, can be compared. For there to be an equivalence, the death penalty would have to punish a criminal who had warned his victim of the date at which he would inflict a horrible death on him, and who, from that moment forward, had confined him at mercy for months. Such a monster is not encountered in private life. In other words, even if you say that this guy in South Carolina planned it, he planned it for a few weeks, he was not insane, he really he was premeditated, yet when we put him to death, according to this approach, we're basically premeditating his death much more than what he did. Because he planned it for a month, we're planning it for 5 years. And so there's a certain coldness to telling someone when we're going to put you to death, and so the person is constantly anxious about it, and we say how we're going to do it, and we're planning someone's death. And so, you know, however long someone actually planned a murder, the fact that they're getting the death penalty was planned even even longer, much longer. And so, according to that approach, so there's that, and then there's also the deterrence factor, which could be that statistics say that really it doesn't deter you from, it doesn't deter murderers, and we'll actually talk about that in a Mishnah. Another Mishnah talks about that, but perhaps a person is not deterred from carrying out a murder, even if there is the death penalty, because like you said, in the heat of the moment, you're not thinking about it. So there could have been 10 death penalty, executions, let's say, in 6 months, but even after that, if a person decides to kill someone, they're not necessarily thinking of the punishment when they do it. So if you say it's a deterrent and it's not really a deterrent, so then why do it? Okay. The other approach, or another approach on the opposite side of the spectrum in favor of death penalty, is from Kant, who says that if he had committed a murder, he must die. In this case, there is no substitute that will satisfy the requirements of legal justice. There is no sameness of kind between death and remaining alive, even under the most miserable conditions, and consequently, there is no equality between the crime and the retribution unless the criminal is judicially condemned and put to death. So that's the opposite approach, because that's saying that we could put him in life in prison, a murderer of one person, of 10 people, but it's never, we're not acquitting it. We're not doing true justice because he killed them, but he's staying alive. Yes, he's going to be life in prison, but we're not acquitting, we're not evening the scales of justice. So perhaps that's a ruling, that's an argument in favor of the death penalty, if you really want to even the scales of justice and say that if you killed someone, right, a life for a life. Okay, so at this point, does anyone have any thoughts? I mean, I'm sure you've, thought about the death penalty at some point, if you're pro or if you're against. As we've seen so far, even in Jewish literature, there seems to be a push and a pull. If you go, I didn't put it on your sheet. There are verses that support what Kant is saying. Psukim, at the beginning of the Torah, and I think it's Parshat Noach, which says, "But for your own lifeblood, I will require a reckoning. I will require it of every beast, of man. Too, will I require a reckoning for human life, of every man, for that of his fellow man." The next verse, "Whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed. For in his image did God make man." So according to those verses, it sounds like sort of a life for a life. That if a person, by man shall his, right, whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed. That you have to, pay for what you did, even if it's with your life, if you killed someone else. So again, that seems to support what Kant is saying, that if you really want to be fair to the victim, you need to kill the culprit. You need to kill the murderer, and then everything will be even.
Does the law apply if somebody kills a woman? Is the value of the woman
the same? Yeah, 100%. Now, on the other side, going back to the anti-death penalty side, you could say a life, killing the murderer is not going to bring back the victim. You can think that it will, but it won't. And so why kill two people? It's enough that one person was killed. Why, why kill another person? It's not going to bring back the victim. Again, a whole world of questions, all compelling thing. This is why it's probably the one of the most debated, and Supreme Court deals with it, and different states have different standards, of course. And you can argue all these arguments, and probably many more have been argued in court and in legal papers. It's a very, maybe it depends on the type of situation.
One answer would bring another question.
One answer brings another question. Right. Very good.
Why
it's a back and forth.
Why shouldn't that killer make to kill himself? Why should I be a murderer to kill him?
Right.
He should be made to kill himself because he killed.
How do you make him kill himself?
What?
How do you make him kill himself?
Well, this is another question, but philosophically, really, why should I be a murderer to him because he was a murderer?
I think you're actually agreeing with your main point.
I'm not against that.
Well, no, I thought you were saying that the state should not be granted permission to kill someone. That's what I thought you were saying, but you said that maybe there could be another way for him to die, but not...
What would make him kill him?
Yeah, I know. I was saying, but I'm not sure what that would look like.
Only God has the right to decide if that person should live or die.
Right. Right. But at the same time, we did have a Mishnah that talked about, when the human courts can decide. But you're saying philosophically we can never take another life in judgment. It has to be that God, which basically means that maybe he'll die, falling off a cliff. But short of that, we can't judge him, put him to death. I'm not sure 100% if that's the Jewish approach totally, because then there wouldn't be a concept of the judges dealing with the case. They would just say, we don't, there is no penalty of murder, but I don't think that's...
They do the best they can.
In other words, we look into it. Whether we actually do it or not is a separate question, which we're talking about. But we do go through the process of looking into it. Yeah. Fine. Now I want to get to one second. Yeah. Okay. We're coming to the end. I want to just do another Mishnah in Makot, which is also about. Actually, Makot is partially about what I said before about the accidental murderer. A very interesting Mishnah, which reflects the different ideas of should we actually do the death penalty or not, right? We've said that maybe you should if, the witnesses are pressed, but if they come through, then perhaps we should do it. But now we're getting to another Mishnah that talks about, from a personal perspective, different rabbis discussing what they would have done had they been judges in a capital case. So I think it's in your sheet for those that have it, the third page. It starts off by saying, a Sanhedrin, that would execute. I think you have it. So this is cited in all the papers about the Jewish view on death penalty. A Sanhedrin that would execute somebody once in 7 years would be considered destructive. In other words, you need to try to find the innocent, the accused, innocent as best as you can. So not only is it innocent until proven guilty, it's innocent and we don't want to prove him guilty. Unless we have to. But really, we don't want to. And if a Sanhedrin would find someone guilty, even once in 7 years, that would be called a murderous or destructive basin. In other words, it should never happen that basin should apply the death penalty, because you should try to find some way to get him off. Okay, we'll keep that thought in mind. Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah says once in 70 years, meaning it's again, these numbers are trying to just make a point that even once in 70 years, there should never be a murder in the Sanhedrin, right? That meaning there should never be a capital punishment. You should never execute someone for murder in the Sanhedrin. It just shouldn't happen.
That's for sure.
Rabbi Tarfon and Rabbi Akiva say, if we were on the basin, nobody would have been executed. So, again, they're just raising the ante and saying that they're just not in favor of the death penalty at all, and they wouldn't have done it, because it's, again, so why do they say that? So perhaps for some of the reasons that we've been saying that, you know, you're if you're not sure, don't do it, or perhaps it doesn't bring the guy back, or it doesn't deter anyone from doing it, etc. But they're against it. Now, Maimonides says a few different interesting things. So the first thing he says over here is that even according to these first group of rabbis, that if you do your due diligence and you still see the accused as guilty, then you have to go ahead and execute even as many as you can. Meaning that yes, it should be that that you shouldn't. You really should try to avoid the death penalty. But if push comes to shove, and you're 100% sure, like perhaps for instance, you know, the case in South Carolina where they had the gun and they had the video evidence and they had the motive, and the guy basically admitted it. So if in Jewish law, there would have had to be witnesses and warning, which there wasn't. So in Jewish law, he would have not been put to death because of that. You could call it a technicality. But maybe in secular law, Judaism would say that according to your statutes, that perhaps you should, because it's so clear-cut. Okay? Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel, though, has a different approach. He's the last rabbi, and he says the opposite. He says, they perhaps are referring to these other rabbis, would have increased violence in Israel. In other words, Rabbi Shimon Gamliel says, wait a second, I disagree. I don't think we should be bending backwards to save the accused. I think that if these rabbis would have said and would have done what they said, that they wouldn't have put anyone to death, it wouldn't have deterred murderers, and therefore murderers would have been rampant because they would have known that there's no punishment of death, right? So we'll get to that in a second in terms of an alternative punishment. But just from this perspective, because Judaism does say that technically there is a death penalty in theory, so if it's so his approach is that if you haven't, again, we keep thinking that the accused is an innocent, sweet guy. He could be a monster. And so if he deserves to die for his crimes, then he should be executed. And Rabbi Shimon Gamliel says that if you don't, and everyone knows that in Basin they're not going to administer the death penalty, so what's to deter them from doing, you know, from killing? Okay?
Say that was accidental. How do they prove
So accidental, you mean how do they prove that?
An accidental death. I was playing with a gun and I killed my friend.
So how do you know it was an accident and not on purpose?
So
there's witnesses for that also. I mean, there's a whole process for that also. How do you know? Because, of course, there we don't have a warning because he didn't know he would do it. So it's a different set of circumstances. But I think, as a start, he would go to the cities of refuge just to be safe, right? And then they would bring him back to the courts and they would try to figure it out further as best as they can, if it was accidental or not. But first, he has to assume that he did it. He accident, he goes, and then they try to figure it out afterwards. Okay? Now, one question that Rabbi Shimon Gamliel is touching on is, well, if theoretically there is this concept of the death penalty for murder, and there's lots of literature about it, both biblical and Talmudic, so then why are these different rabbis, are they trying to subvert the judgment? Are they trying to say, "Oh, you know, it doesn't really matter. We don't actually follow, you know, what it says, which is that you do, execute a murderer. We don't actually do it, even though the Torah says to do it, and even though the Talmud says and talks about it." We don't do it. So one could ask, why are we trying to avoid it? Okay. So there could be two approaches, and with this we'll close. One is from Maimonides, which is what you said before. Right? He says as follows: if we do not inflict punishment even when the offense is most probable, so we're 99% sure that Joe killed Lewis, but we're not 100%, we're 99% sure. The worst that could happen is that someone who is really guilty will be found innocent, right? That really he did it, but we're saying that he's innocent. That's the worst that could happen. But if punishment was given based on estimation and circumstantial evidence, it is possible that someday an innocent person would be executed. Now, there are, definitely stories about people, I think maybe executed, but for sure people put in life in prison, that it comes out later, even 20 years later, that they didn't do it based on DNA or whatever. And it's very sad, obviously, that they had to be in jail even though they didn't do it. But,
this time I'm against death penalty, because how do I know 5 or 10 years later they find them innocent?
Exactly. That's what Rambam is saying. But if punishment was given on... Right. It is possible that an innocent person would be executed. It is preferable and more proper that even 1,000 guilty people be set free, that's an important point, than to someday execute even one innocent person. We'd rather err on the side of innocence.
There's a Jewish belief, better the guilty go than the innocent to be punished.
That's, I just said, it comes from right here. It comes from right here, from the Rambam. Now, the question is, so if we don't prosecute them and they really did it, so what will happen to them? Are they going to be scot-free? Are they just going to have a great life after and not be responsible? How do we hold them responsible if they probably did it, but we don't know 100%, so we don't execute them? So the Rambam actually says that... Okay, so before that, first of all, we trust, and this is similar to what you were saying before, not exactly, we trust that God will take care of someone if they really murdered someone but were let off the hook. again, I quoted before about, I mentioned falling off a cliff. Now, that doesn't always happen, but we have to trust that if a guy is not put to death, even if if they really did something horrible, they'll get what's coming to them at some point.
They'll get sick.
They'll get sick, right? Something bad will happen to them. Maybe only in the next world, whatever. So God is our, so to speak, backup. And so if we don't if we don't do it, God, we have to trust that God will do it at some point. So the concept of jail is very interesting because it's not really discussed in the literature so much, but I did see that Maimonides does talk about the concept of jail, that if the guy, let's say, is exonerated on a technicality, meaning, oh, you know, you couldn't tell, you know, you didn't remember what shoes he was wearing or what shirt he was wearing, which means maybe you as the witness didn't really see it, so we have to let him go. Like we said before, we push the witnesses. But does that mean he goes for free? So it could be not. It could be that there's a concept of putting him in jail and he needs to, like, waste away, so to speak. I'm not sure if it's not really discussed so much, this concept of being put in jail, but there is that possibility. And again, when that would happen, meaning when would they let a guy go totally free, and when they would say no, he needs to, you know, be put in jail, is unclear a little bit. How you decide which person that's let off the hook from the death penalty, whether they have to go to jail or not. But there is perhaps that concept, so we're not killing the person, but rather, we are taking care of them. Now, the last thing is that, very interestingly, Rav Moshe Feinstein, we talked about last time a little bit, the rabbi in Lower East Side of New York, the great scholar, was asked by the governor of New York what the Jewish view is on the death penalty, right? So I'll just summarize what he says, because he addresses it, and he says that the Torah reserves capital punishment for those sins which are very serious, like murder, kidnapping, and idolatry, sexually prohibited relations. The perpetrator in these cases are unrestrained and is capable of doing whatever cruel acts are in his heart that he thinks are for his benefit. However, the death penalty is not administered out of hatred to evildoers or fear for the welfare of society, because the Talmud tells us, like we just said, that God will punish the transgressors. So we're not doing it for revenge, and we're not doing it for deterrence, but we're doing it... at this point it's unclear, so why are we doing it? Okay, let's keep going. That, in fact, is the Maimonides, what he says. So on the one hand, the purpose of capital punishment is to let people know the severity of these prohibitions so that they will not transgress them. So there's another idea, which is that we do the death penalty, why? To show how evil murder is to everyone else. And that's perhaps another category, another approach. On the other hand, the laws of capital punishment emphasize the importance of every soul. Therefore, only the Sanhedrin with proper guidance and knowledge and the greatest scholarship that can be on the courts, and they need to be humble and God-fearing people. And they also have to hate money and love the truth, because judges could be corrupt. Now, we have juries, not judges, which is a little bit different, right? A jury of our peers that are just regular people. The Jewish court had a different approach where there was no jury. There was only these very brilliant incapable scholars as judges. So that's different also. And they also have to hate money because they could be corrupted to make the wrong ruling because they're being paid to do so. So they have to be scot-free and right. They also have to be merciful and somewhat young. You have to know what the stress is of raising children. Okay, fine. Okay, so now, as a consequence of these two factors, right, meaning the factors being everything we've said, that we make it very difficult for their actually for the witnesses to actually say and trust them, there was almost no Jewish murderers because of the awareness of the severity of the prohibition of murder and because they were educated by means of the Torah and the punishments of the Torah to understand the seriousness of the crime. They were afraid of the crime itself, not just the punishment for the crime. In other words, Jewish people were told, since we know that it's that theoretically there is a death penalty, and so the fact that we go through the process of doing it is itself a deterrent because it shows people, and we educate Jewish people about how bad murder is based on what we do in these kind of cases, that we take it very, very seriously. And so that actually could help to deter murder. However, this use of the Torah system to run society was only when the crime of murder was not common, but was simply the result of someone's great lust or some quarrel concerning money or honor. But when people killed simply because it was viewed as insignificant, and the murderer was simply a callous or cruel person, or similarly, if there was a great deal of murders and wickedness in the world, then a different system of law was utilized that was concerned with the pragmatic question of stopping killing, and the goal became saving the society. So what I think he's saying in summary is that there's a difference between situations, that if you have a mostly non-murderous society, and it was just one person, so in that case, perhaps we don't put to death because we're not worried that other people will think, oh, murder is not a big deal. We see that no one's murdering. Thank God. People know how bad murder is. They're not doing it. So perhaps we don't need to administer capital punishment because it's a good society. There's a bad apple, but maybe we can deal with him, you know, separately. But if there was murders going on all the time and people didn't see it as significant and they weren't deterred from it, so then maybe you need to go back to the death penalty to stop it. So he's saying that it depends on what kind of society there is, when you should consider doing it or not. And of course, different states have different views, and so there's different laws. But again, this important point that he makes, that we don't just do the death penalty to take revenge, because we know that God will even it out. We mainly do it to show, or we mainly consider doing it to show how severe the crime is, because we want everyone to know, even though it's obvious to 99% of us, you know, of the world, that you can't, 99.99% that murder is wrong, but those that do it and others that see it might think that it's not a big deal, and so the Torah is telling you, no, it is a big deal, and, you know, you ought to be killed for it. Whether we actually do it or not is another question. Okay, questions, comments?
What about the assassin?
Assassin?
Assassin. He's not a murderer. He's someone who is ordered to go and kill such person.
So someone that's paid to kill someone else, can they be considered a murderer, whether in secular law or Jewish law, because they didn't decide on their own to do it, but they were told to do it from someone else?
So what about him?
Well, that could be kind of like, you know, the Nazi guards who said that they had to do it. But, I mean, I don't want to get into that, but that could be a similar thing. Is that a valid excuse to say that you were told to do it? So, I think the Talmud says that if someone tells you to do something, but it's, you know that it's wrong, and, you know, God would say, don't do it, then you should not do it. And don't say, oh, well, I was told to do it. The Talmud has an expression, right? The words of the teacher and the words of the student. Who do you listen to? Right?
So he's thought to be self-proficient.
Yeah, but he didn't have to do it. He's not being compelled
to.
He's being paid for it, but he's making a decision to do it. So why should...
He didn't make the decision. He was sent.
Yeah, he agreed to be sent. He could have said, I'm not going to do it. I mean...
That's a question.
So, I mean, another question would be if someone holds a gun to your head and says you need to kill someone else, and then you do it, are you... You were forced, literally, by your life to do it. So are you held accountable or not for that would be another question. But we're also told that for three sins, we've been saying them over and over again, of murder, idolatry, and immorality, you have to give your life up for.
How is the executioner considered? What category?
Interesting. Right, so let's say... Right. So let's say in Jewish law, the guy that actually does it and puts the guy to death, so if I remember correctly, there's, I think like that's why there's a firing squad, let's say, because you don't want anyone can say, oh, I didn't actually kill him, it was someone else. I think that's why they have that. Because really there's no reason to have 10 people shooting someone other than that. I'm not sure. I think there might be the equivalent in the Jewish court where, like, two people are involved in the beheading so that both of them can say it was really the other guy, although I'm not 100% sure. But someone that executes is... not a murderer in Beis Din, because we told them, the Beis Din told them to do it, and it's they're not being paid to, like, they're not being paid to do it, they're carrying out the law in this case. Meaning, the case of the assassin, you're killing someone, presumably not a murderer.
He's a proficient.
No, but you're killing, the person that you're hired to kill is a regular person.
Yeah.
As opposed to her case, where the Beis Din is killing someone that they've decided after many hours and many witnesses is actually guilty. So that could be a difference.
But a firing squad, what is do it and should do it if it has to be done. Not between two people.
Right.
Firing squad when you don't know which
guy. Yeah. So again, it depends. Is the guy, was he really guilty? Or is it like in other parts of the world where they do it and, you know, because, a girl kissed a boy, right? Or a girl drove or whatever. You know, Judaism has no concept of killing someone for minor acts like that, like in other places. Like what we've seen, the bottom line is that whether we actually do it or not, we take it very seriously, and we don't just execute, no pun intended, the death penalty just willy-nilly, just out of the blue. We actually make sure that if we're going to do it, it's the right person. And that's why a lot of times we don't end up doing it, because as we saw from Rambam, that it's better, like you said, to let 1,000 guilty people go than to kill one innocent person. So just to summarize, we saw different approaches, different thoughts about Judaism's relationship to the death penalty, both in Jewish law and in secular law. And so it's a complicated, loaded topic, but there are a lot of interesting points that we saw regarding this topic. So, thank you all for coming.
Than the killer.
Thank you.
They killed intentionally, so did the killer. So I am not putting up the and on the top of it getting paid for it.
I understand what you're saying. Yeah. Okay. Everyone have a great day. Thank you. You could keep them, but if you're just